No Truce with Kings.
Song, Charlie! Give us a song! Yay, Charlie!
The whole mess was drunk, and the junior officers at the far end of the table were only somewhat noisier than their seniors near the colonel. Rugs and hangings could not much muffle the racket, shouts, stamping boots, thump of fists on the oak and clash of cups raised aloft, that rang from wall to stony wall. High up among shadows that hid the rafters they hung from, the regimental banners stirred in a draft as if to join the chaos. Below, the light of bracketed lanterns and bellowing fireplace winked on trophies and weapons. Autumn comes early on Echo Summit, and it was storming outside. Wind hooted past the watchtowers and rain rushed in the courtyards. An undertone that walked through the buildings and down all corridors, as if the story were true that the unit's dead came out of the cemetery each September 19th night and tried to join the celebration but had forgotten how. No one let it bother him, here or in the enlisted barracks, except maybe the Hex Major. The 3rd Division, the Catamounts, was known as the most riotous gang in the Army of the Pacific States of America, and of its regiments, the Rolling Stones, who held Fort Nakamura, were the wildest.
Go on, boy. Lead off. You've got the closest thing to a voice in the whole goddamn Sierra, Colonel McKenzie called.
He loosened the collar of his black dress tunic and lounged back, legs asprawl, pipe in one hand and beaker of whiskey in the other. A thick-set man with blue wrinkled meshed eyes and a battered face, his cropped hair turned gray, but his mustache still arrogantly red.
Charlie is my darling, sang Captain Hulse.
He stopped as the noise abated a little. Young Lieutenant Amadeo got up, grinned, and launched into one they knew well.
I am a Catamountian. I guard a border pass. And every time I venture out, the cold will freeze my...
Colonel, sir, begging your pardon.
Kenzie twisted around and looked into the face of Sergeant Irwin. The man's expression shocked him.
Yes? I am a bloody hero of decorated vet. The Order of the Purple Shaft with pineapple clusters yet...
Message just come in, sir. Major Spire asks to see you right away.
Spire, who didn't like being drunk, had volunteered for duty tonight. Otherwise, men drew lots for it on a holiday. Remembering the last word from San Francisco, Mackenzie grew chill. The mess bawled forth the chorus, not noticing when the colonel knocked out his pipe and rose. The guns go boom, hey tiddly boom, the rockets vroom, the arrows zoom, from slug to slug, it's damn small room, get me out of here and back to the good old womb, hey doodle-dee-day.
All right-thinking catamounts maintained that they could operate better with the booze sloshing up to their eardrums than any other outfit cold sober.
Mackenzie ignored the tingle in his veins, forgot it. He walked a straight line to the door, automatically taking his sidearm off the rack as he passed by. The song pursued him into the hall.
For maggots in the rations, we hardly ever lack. You bite into a sandwich and the sandwich bites right back. The coffee is the finest grade of Sacramento mud. The ketchup's good in combat, though, for simulating blood.
Chorus.
The drums go bump, a tumpity tump. The bugles make like Gabriel's trump.
Lanterns were far apart in the passage. Portraits of former commanders watched the colonel and the sergeant from eyes that were hidden in grotesque darkness. Footfalls clattered too loudly here.
I've got an arrow in my rump, right about and rearward heroes on the jump. Hey, doodle-dee-day.
Mackenzie went between a pair of field pieces flanking a stairway. They had been captured at Rock Springs during the Wyoming War a generation ago, and upward. There was more distance between places in this keep than his legs liked at their present age. But it was old, had been added to decade by decade, and it needed to be massive, chiseled and mortared from Sierra granite, for it guarded a key to the nation. More than one army had broken against its revetments before the Nevada marches were pacified, and more young men than Mackenzie wished to think about had gone from this base to die among angry strangers. But she's never been attacked from the west,
God or whatever you are, you can spare her that, can't you? The command office was lonesome at this hour. The room where Sergeant Irwin had his desk lay so silent. No clerks pushing pens, no messengers going in or out, no wives making a splash of color with their dresses as they waited to see the colonel about some problem down in the village. When he opened the door to the inner room, though, Mackenzie heard the wind shriek around the angle of the wall. Rain slashed at the black window pane and ran down in streams, which the lantern turned molten.
Here the colonel is, sir, Irwin said in an uneven voice. He gulped and closed the door behind Mackenzie. Spire stood by the commander's desk. It was a beat-up old object with little upon it. An inkwell, a letter basket, an interphone, a photograph of Nora, faded in these dozen years since her death. The major was a tall and gaunt man, hook-nosed, going bald on top. His uniform always looked unpressed somehow. But he had the sharpest brain in the cats, Mackenzie thought. And Christ, how could any man read as many books as Phil did? Officially, he was the adjutant. In practice, the chief advisor.
Well, Mackenzie said. The alcohol did not seem to numb him, rather make him too acutely aware of things. How the lantern smelled hot. When would they get a big enough generator to run electric lights? And the floor was hard under his feet, and a crack went through the plaster of the north wall, and the stove wasn't driving out much of the chill. He forced bravado, stuck thumbs in his belt, and rocked back on his heels. Well, Phil, what's wrong now?
Wire from Frisco, Spire said. He had been folding and unfolding a piece of paper, which he handed over.
Well, why not a radio call? Telegram's less likely to be intercepted. This one's in code at that. Irwin decoded it for me. What the hell kind of nonsense is this? Have a look, Jimbo, and you'll find out. It's for you anyway. Direct from GHQ. Mackenzie focused on Irwin's scrawl, the usual formalities of an order. Then... You are hereby notified that the Pacific States Senate has passed a bill of impeachment against Owen Brodsky, formerly judge of the Pacific States of America, and deprived him of office. As of 2000 hours of this date, former Vice Humphrey Fallon is judge of the PSA in accordance with the law of succession. The existence of dissident elements constituting a public danger has made it necessary for Judge Fallon to put the entire nation under martial law, effective at 2100 hours this date. You are therefore issued the following instructions. 1. The above intelligence is to be held strictly confidential until an official proclamation is made. No person who has received knowledge in the course of transmitting this message shall divulge same to any other person whatsoever. Violators of this section and anyone thereby receiving information shall be placed immediately in solitary confinement to await court-martial. 2. You will sequestrate all arms and ammunition except for 10% of available stock and keep same under heavy guard. 3. You will keep all men in the Fort Nakamura area until you are relieved. Your relief is Colonel Simon Hollis, who will start from San Francisco tomorrow morning with one battalion. They are expected to arrive at Fort Nakamura in 5 days, at which time you will surrender your command to him. Colonel Hollis will designate those officers and enlisted men who are to be replaced by members of his battalion, which will be integrated into the regiment. You will lead the men replaced back to San Francisco and report to Brigadier General Mendoza at New Fort Baker. To avoid provocations, these men will be disarmed except for officers' sidearms. 4. For your private information, Captain Thomas Danielis has been appointed senior aide to Colonel Hollis. 5. You are again reminded that the Pacific States of America are under martial law because of a national emergency. Complete loyalty to the legal government is required. Any mutinous talk must be severely punished. Anyone giving aid or comfort to the Brodsky faction is guilty of treason and will be dealt with accordingly. Gerald O'Donnell, General, APSA, CINC. Thunder went off in the mountains like artillery. It was a while before Mackenzie stirred, then merely to lay the paper on his desk. He could only summon feeling slowly, up into a hollowness that filled his skin. They dared, Spire said without tone. They really did. Huh? Mackenzie swiveled eyes around to the Major's face. Spire didn't meet that stare. He was concentrating his own gaze on his hands, which were now rolling a cigarette. But the words jerked from him, harsh and quick. I can guess what happened. The War Hawks have been hollering for impeachment ever since Brodsky compromised the border dispute with West Canada. And Fallon, yeah, he's got ambitions of his own. But his partisans are a minority, and he knows it. Electing him vice helped soothe the War Hawks some, but he'd never make Judge the regular way, because Brodsky isn't going to die of old age before Fallon does. And anyhow, more than 50% of the Senate are sober, satisfied boss men who don't agree that the PSA has a divine mandate to reunify the continent. I don't see how an impeachment could get through an honestly convened Senate. More likely, they'd vote out Fallon. But a Senate had been called, Mackenzie said. The words sounded to him like someone else talking. The newscasts told us. Sure. Called for yesterday to debate ratification of the treaty with West Canada. But the boss men are scattered up and down the country, each at his own station. They have to get to San Francisco. A couple of arranged delays. Hell, if a bridge just happened to be blown on the Boise Railroad, a round dozen of Brodsky's staunchest supporters wouldn't arrive on time. So the Senate has a quorum, all right. But every one of Fallon's supporters are there. And so many of the rest are missing that the War Hawks have a clear majority. Then they meet on a holiday when no cityman is paying attention. Presto, impeachment and a new judge. Spire finished his cigarette and stuck it between his lips while he fumbled for a match. A muscle twitched in his jaw. You sure? Mackenzie mumbled. He thought dimly that this moment was like one time he'd visited Puget City and been invited for a sail on the Guardian's yacht, and a fog had closed in. Everything was cold and blind, with nothing you could catch in your hands. Of course I'm not sure, Spire snarled. Nobody will be sure until it's too late. The matchbox shook in his grasp. They got a new sink, too, I noticed. Uh-huh. They'd want to replace everybody they can't trust as fast as possible. And DeBarros was a Brodsky appointee. The match flared with a hellish skrit. Spire inhaled till his cheeks collapsed. You and me included, naturally. The regiment reduced to a minimum armament so that nobody will get ideas about resistance when the new colonel arrives. You'll note he's coming with a battalion at his heels just the same, just in case. Otherwise, he could take a plane and be here tomorrow. Well, why not a train? Mackenzie caught a whiff of smoke and felt for his pipe. The bowl was hot in his tunic pocket. Probably all rolling stock has to head north. Get troops among the boss men there to forestall a revolt. The valleys are safe enough. Peaceful ranchers and Esper colonies. None of them will potshot Fallonite soldiers marching to Garrison Echo and Donner outposts. A dreadful scorn weighted Spire's words. What are we going to do? I assume Fallon's takeover followed legal forms, that there was a quorum, Spire said. Nobody will ever agree whether it was really constitutional. I've been reading this damned message over and over since Irwin decoded it. There's a lot between the lines. I think Brodsky's at large, for instance. If he were under arrest, this would have said as much. And there'd have been less worry about rebellion. Maybe some of his household troops smuggled him away in time. He'll be hunted like a jackrabbit, of course. Mackenzie took out his pipe, but forgot he had done so. Tom's coming without replacements, he said thinly. Yeah, your son-in-law. That was a smart touch, wasn't it? A kind of hostage for your good behavior, but also a backhand promise that you and yours won't suffer if you report in as ordered. Tom's a good kid. He'll stand by his own. This is his regiment, too, Mackenzie said. He squared his shoulders. He wanted to fight West Canada, sure. Young and a lot of Pacificans did get killed in the Idaho Panhandle during the skirmishes. Women and kids among them. Well, Spire said, you're the colonel, Jimbo. What should we do?
Oh, Jesus, I don't know.
I'm nothing but a soldier. The pipe stem broke in Mackenzie's fingers. But we're not some boss man's personal militia here. We swore to support the Constitution. I can't see where Brodsky's yielding some of our claims in Idaho as grounds for impeachment. I think he was right. Well, a coup d'etat by any other name would stink as bad. You may not be much of a student of current events, Jimbo, but you know as well as I do what Fallon's judgeship will mean. War with West Canada is almost the least of it. Fallon also stands for a strong central government. He'll find ways to grind down the old boss man families. A lot of their heads and scions will die in the front lines. That stunt goes back to David and Uriah. Others will be accused of collusion with the Brodsky people, not altogether falsely, and impoverished by fines. Esper communities will get nice big land grants so their economic competition can bankrupt still other estates. Later wars will keep bossmen away for years at a time, unable to supervise their own affairs, which will therefore go to the devil. And thus we march toward the glorious goal of reunification. If Esper Central favors him, what can we do? I've heard enough about PSI blasts. I can't ask my men to face them. You could ask your men to face the hell bomb itself, Jimbo, and they would. Mackenzie has commanded the Rolling Stones for over 50 years. Yes, I thought, Tom, someday. We've watched this brewing for a long time. Remember the talk we had about it last week?
Uh-huh.
I might also remind you that the Constitution was written explicitly to confirm the separate regions in their ancient liberties.
Let me alone, Mackenzie shouted. I don't know what's right or wrong, I tell you. Let me alone.
Spire fell silent, watching him through a screen of foul smoke. Mackenzie walked back and forth a while, boots slamming the floor like drum beats. Finally, he threw the broken pipe across the room so it shattered. Okay. He must ram each word past the tension in his throat. Irwin's a good man who can keep his lip buttoned. Send him out to cut the telegraph line a few miles downhill. Make it look as if the storm did it. The wire breaks often enough, heaven knows. Officially, then, we never got GHQ's message. That gives us a few days to contact Sierra Command headquarters. I won't go against General Cruikshank, but I'm pretty sure which way he'll go if he sees a chance. Tomorrow, we prepare for action. There'll be no trick to throw back Hollis's battalion, and they'll need a while to bring some real strength against us. Before then, the first snow should be along, and we'll be shut off for the winter. Only we can use skis and snowshoes ourselves to keep in touch with the other units and organize something. By spring, we'll see what happens. Thanks, Jimbo. The wind almost drowned Spire's words. I'd better go tell Laura. Yeah. Spire squeezed Mackenzie's shoulder. There were tears in the major's eyes. Mackenzie went out with parade ground steps, ignoring Irwin. Down the hall, down a stairway at its other end, past guarded doors where he returned salutes without really noticing, and so to his own quarters in the south wing. His daughter had gone to sleep already. He took a lantern off its hook in his bleak little parlor and entered her room. She had come back here while her husband was in San Francisco. For a moment, Mackenzie couldn't quite remember why he had sent Tom there. He passed a hand over his stubbly scalp as if to squeeze something out. Oh, yes. Ostensibly to arrange for a new issue of uniforms. Actually, to get the boy out of the way until the political crisis had blown over. Tom was too honest for his own good, an admirer of Fallon and the Esper movement. His outspokenness had led to friction with his brother officers. They were mostly of boss man stock, or from well-to-do protectee families. The existing social order had been good to them. But Tom Danielis began as a fisher lad in a poverty-stricken village on the Mendocino coast. In spare moments, he'd learned the three R's from a local Esper. Once literate, he joined the army and earned a commission by sheer guts and brains. He had never forgotten that the Espers helped the poor and that Fallon promised to help the Espers. Then, too, battle, glory, reunification, federal democracy, those were heady dreams when you were young. Laura's room was little changed since she left it to get married last year. And she had only been 17 then. Objects survived which had belonged to a small person with pigtails and starched frocks. A teddy bear loved to shapelessness. A dollhouse her father had built. Her mother's picture drawn by a corporal who stopped a bullet at Salt Lake. Oh, God, how much she had come to look like her mother. Dark hair streamed over a pillow turned gold by the light. Mackenzie shook her as gently as he was able. She awoke instantly, and he saw the terror within her.
Dad, anything about Tom?
He's okay. Mackenzie set the lantern on the floor and himself on the edge of the bed. Her fingers were cold where they caught at his hand.
He isn't, she said. I know you too well.
He's not been hurt yet. I hope he won't be. Mackenzie braced himself. Because she was a soldier's daughter, he told her the truth in a few words. But he was not strong enough to look at her while he did. When he had finished, he sat dully listening to the rain.
You're going to revolt, she whispered.
I'm going to consult with SCHQ and follow my commanding officer's orders, Mackenzie said.
You know what they'll be, once he knows you'll back him.
Mackenzie shrugged. His head had begun to ache. Hangover started already? He'd need a good deal more booze before he could sleep tonight. No time for sleep. Yes, there would be. Tomorrow would do to assemble the regiment in the courtyard and address them from the breach of Black Hepzibah, as a Mackenzie of the Rolling Stones always addresses his men. And he found himself ludicrously recalling a day when he and Nora and this girl here had gone rowing on Lake Tahoe. The water was the color of Nora's eyes, green and blue, and with sunlight flimmering across the surface, but so clear you could see the rocks on the bottom. And Laura's own little bottom had stuck straight in the air as she trailed her hands astern. She sat thinking for a space before saying flatly, I suppose you can't be talked out of it. He shook his head.
Well, can I leave tomorrow early then?
Yes, I'll get you a coach.
To hell with that. I'm better in the saddle than you are.
Okay. A couple of men to escort you, though. Mackenzie drew a long breath. Maybe you can persuade Tom.
No, I can't. Please don't ask me to, Dad.
He gave her the last gift he could. I wouldn't want you to stay. That'd be shirking your own duty. Tell Tom I still think he's the right man for you. Good night, Duck. It came out too fast, but he dared not delay. When she began to cry, he must unfold her arms from his neck and depart the room. But I had not expected so much killing.
Nor I, at this stage of things. There will be more yet, I am afraid, before the immediate purpose is achieved. You told me... I told you our hopes, Muir. You know as well as I that the great science is only exact at the broadest scale of history. Individual events are subject to statistical fluctuation. That is an easy way out, is it not, to describe sentient beings dying in the mud? You are new here. Theory is one thing. Adjustment to practical necessities is another. Do you think it does not hurt me to see that happen which I myself have helped plan? Oh, I know, I know. Which makes it no easier to live with my guilt. To live with your responsibilities, you mean. Your phrase. No, this is not semantic trickery. The distinction is real. You have read reports and seen films, but I was here with the first expedition, and here I have been for more than two centuries. Their agony is no abstraction to me.
But it was different when we first discovered them. The aftermath of their nuclear wars was still so horribly present. That was when they needed us. The poor, starveling anarchs. And we did nothing but observe.
Now you are hysterical. Could we come in blindly, ignorant of every last fact about them, and expect to be anything but one more disruptive element? An element whose effects we ourselves would not have been able to predict. That would have been criminal indeed. Like a surgeon who started to operate as soon as he met the patient without so much as taking a case history. We had to let them go their own way while we studied in secret. You have no idea how desperately hard we worked to gain information and understanding. That work goes on. It was only 70 years ago that we felt enough assurance to introduce the first new factor into this one selected society. As we continue to learn more, the plan will be adjusted. It may take us 1,000 years to complete our mission. But meanwhile, they have pulled themselves back out of the wreckage. They are finding their own answers to their problems. What right have we to... I begin to wonder, Muir, what right you have to claim even the title of apprentice psychodynamician. Consider what their answers actually amount to. Most of the planet is still in a state of barbarism. This continent has come farthest toward recovery because of having the widest distribution of technical skills and equipment before the destruction. But what social structure has evolved? A jumble of quarrelsome successor states. A feudalism where the balance of political, military, and economic power lies with the landed aristocracy of all archaic things. A score of languages and subcultures developing along their own incompatible lines. A blind technology worship inherited from the ancestral society that, unchecked, will lead them in the end back to a machine civilization as demoniac as the one that tore itself apart 3 centuries ago. Are you distressed that a few hundred men have been killed because our agents promoted a revolution which did not come off quite so smoothly as we hoped? Well, you have the word of the great science itself that without our guidance, the totaled misery of this race through the next 5,000 years would outweigh by 3 orders of magnitude whatever pain we are forced to inflict.
Yes, of course. I realize I'm being emotional. It is difficult not to be at first, I suppose.
You should be thankful that your initial exposure to the hard necessities of the plan was so mild. There is worse to come.
So I have been told.
In abstract terms. But consider the reality. A government ambitious to restore the old nation will act aggressively. thus embroiling itself in prolonged wars with powerful neighbors, both directly and indirectly, through the operation of economic factors they are too naive to control, the aristocrats and freeholders will be eroded away by those wars. Anomic democracy will replace their system, first dominated by a corrupt capitalism, and later by sheer force of whoever holds the central government. But there will be no place for the vast displaced proletariat, the one-time landowners and the foreigners incorporated by conquest. They will offer fertile soil to any demagogue. The empire will undergo endless upheaval, civil strife, despotism, decay, and outside invasion. Oh, we will have much to answer for before we are done.
Do you think, when we see the final result, will the blood wash off us?
No. We pay the heaviest price of all. Spring in the High Sierra is cold, wet, snowbanks melting away from forest floor and giant rocks, rivers in spate until their canyons clang, a breeze ruffling puddles in the road. The first green breath across the aspen seems infinitely tender against pine and spruce, which gloom into a brilliant sky. A raven swoops low.
Quack! Quack!
Look out for that damn hawk. But then you cross timberline, and the world becomes tumbled blue-gray immensity, with the sun ablaze on what snows remain and the wind sounding hollow in your ears. Captain Thomas Danielis, field artillery, loyalist Army of the Pacific States, turned his horse aside. He was a dark young man, slender and snub-nosed. Behind him, a squad slipped and cursed, dripping mud from feet to helmets, trying to get a gun carrier unstuck. Its alcohol motor was too feeble to do more than spin the wheels. The infantry squelched on past, stoop-shouldered, worn down by altitude and a wet bivouac and pounds of mire on each boot. Their line snaked from around a prow-like crag, up the twisted road and over the ridge ahead. A gust brought the smell of sweat to Danielis. But they were good Joes, he thought. Dirty, dogged, they did their profane best. His own company, at least, was going to get hot food tonight if he had to cook the quartermaster sergeant. The horse's hooves banged on a block of ancient concrete jutting from the muck. If this had been the old days, but wishes weren't bullets. Beyond this part of the range lay lands mostly desert, claimed by the Saints, who were no longer a menace, but with whom there was scant commerce. So the mountain highways had never been considered worth repaving, and the railroad ended at Hangtown. Therefore, the expeditionary force to the Tahoe area must slog through unpeopled forests and icy uplands. God help the poor bastards. God help them in Nakamura, too, Danielis thought. His mouth drew taut. He slapped his hands together and spurred the horse with needless violence. Sparks shot from iron shoes as the beast clattered off the road toward the highest point of the ridge. The man's saber banged his leg. Reining in, he unlimbered his field glasses. From here he could look across a jumbled sweep of mountainscape, where cloud shadows sailed over cliffs and boulders, down into the gloom of a canyon and across to the other side. A few tufts of grass thrust out beneath him, mummy brown, and a marmot wakened early from winter sleep whistled somewhere in the stone confusion. He still couldn't see the castle, nor had he expected to as yet. He knew this country. How well he did. There might be a glimpse of hostile activity, though. It had been eerie to march this far with no sign of the enemy, of anyone else whatsoever. To send out patrols in search of rebel units that could not be found. To ride with shoulder muscles tense against the sniper's arrow that never came. Old Jimbo McKenzie was not one to sit passive behind walls, and the Rolling Stones had not been given their nickname in jest. If Jimbo is alive, How do I know he is? That buzzard yonder may be the very one which hacked out his eyes. Danielis bit his lip and made himself look steadily through the glasses. Don't think about Mackenzie. How he outroared and outdrank and outlaughed you, and you never minded. How he sat knotting his brows over the chessboard where you could mop him up 10 times out of 10, and he never cared. How proud and happy he stood at the wedding. Nor think about Laura, who tried to keep you from knowing how often she wept at night, who now bore a grandchild beneath her heart and woke alone in the San Francisco house from the evil dreams of pregnancy. Every one of those dog faces plodding toward the castle which has killed every army ever sent against it. Every one of them has somebody at home, and hell rejoices at how many have somebody on the rebel side. Better look for hostile spore and let it go at that. Wait! Daniela stiffened. A rider. He focused. One of our own. Fallon's army added a blue band to the uniform. Returning scout. A tingle went along his spine. He decided to hear the report firsthand, but the fellow was still a mile off, perforce riding slowly over the hugger-mugger terrain. There was no hurry about intercepting him. Danielis continued to survey the land. A reconnaissance plane appeared, an ungainly dragonfly with sunlight flashing off a propeller head. Its drone bumbled among rock walls where echoes threw the noise back and forth. Doubtless an auxiliary to the scouts, employing two-way radio communication. Later, the plane would work as a spotter for artillery. There was no use making a bomber of it. Fort Nakamura was proof against anything that today's puny aircraft could drop, and might well shoot the thing down. A shoe scraped behind Danielis. Horse and man whirled as one. His pistol jumped into his hand. It lowered. Oh, excuse me, philosopher. The man in the blue robe nodded. A smile softened his stern face. He must be around 60 years old, hair white and skin lined, but he walked these heights like a wild goat. The yang and yin symbol burned gold on his breast. You're needlessly on edge, son, he said. A trace of Texas accent stretched out his words. The Espers obeyed the laws wherever they lived, but acknowledged no country their own. Nothing less than mankind, perhaps ultimately all life through the space-time universe. Nevertheless, the Pacific states had gained enormously in prestige and influence when the order's unenterable central was established in San Francisco at the time when the city was being rebuilt in earnest. There had been no objection. On the contrary, to the Grand Seeker's desire that Philosopher Woodworth accompany the expedition as an observer. Not even from the chaplains. The churches had finally gotten it straight that the Esper teachings were neutral with respect to religion. Danielis managed a grin. Can you blame me? No blame, but advice. Your attitude isn't useful. Does nothing but wear you out. You've been fighting a battle for weeks before it began. Danielis remembered the apostle who had visited his home in San Francisco by invitation in the hope that Laura might learn some peace. His simile had been still homelier. You only need to wash one dish at a time. The memory brought a smart to Danielis' eyes so that he said roughly, I might relax if you'd use your powers to tell me what's waiting for us. I'm no adept, son. Too much in the material world, I'm afraid. Somebody's got to do the practical work of the order, and someday I'll get the chance to retire and explore the frontier inside me. But you need to start early and stick to it a lifetime to develop your full powers. Woodworth looked across the peaks, seemed almost to merge himself with their loneliness. Danielis hesitated to break into that meditation. He wondered what practical purpose the philosopher was serving on this trip. To bring back a report more accurate than untrained senses and undisciplined emotions could prepare? Yes, that must be it. The Espers might yet decide to take a hand in this war. However, reluctantly, Central had allowed the awesome PSI powers to be released now and again when the order was seriously threatened. And Judge Fallon was a better friend to them than Brodsky or the earlier Senate of Bossmen and House of People's Deputies had been. The horse stamped and blew out its breath in a snort. Woodworth glanced back at the rider. If you ask me, though, he said, I don't reckon you'll find much doing around here. I was in the Rangers myself back home before I saw the way. This country feels empty. If we could know, Danielis exploded. They've had the whole winter to do what they liked in the mountains while the snow kept us out. What scouts we could get in reported a beehive as late as 2 weeks ago. What have they planned? Woodworth made no reply. It flooded from Danielis. He couldn't stop. He had to cover the recollection of Laura bidding him goodbye on his second expedition against her father, 6 months after the first one came home in bloody fragments. If we had the resources, a few wretched little railroads and motor cars, a handful of aircraft, most of our supply trains drawn by mules, what kind of mobility does that give us? And what really drives me crazy, we know how to make what they had in the old days. We've got the books, the information, more maybe than the ancestors. I've watched the electrosmith at Fort Nakamura turn out transistor units with enough bandwidth to carry television no bigger than my fist. I've seen the scientific journals, the research labs, biology, chemistry, astronomy, mathematics, and all useless. Not so, Woodworth answered mildly. Like my own order, the community of scholarship's becoming supernatural. Printing presses, radiophones, telescribes. I say useless. Useless to stop men killing each other because there's no authority strong enough to make them behave. Useless to take a farmer's hands off a horse-drawn plow and put them on the wheel of a tractor. We've got the knowledge, but we can't apply it. You do apply it, son, where too much power and industrial plant isn't required. Remember, the world's a lot poorer in natural resources than it was before the hell bombs. I've seen the Blacklands myself, where the firestorm passed over the Texas oil fields. Woodworth's serenity cracked a little. He turned his eyes back to the peaks. There's oil elsewhere, Danielis insisted. And coal, iron, uranium, everything we need. But the world hasn't got the organization to get at it. Not in any quantity. So we fill the Central Valley with crops that'll yield alcohol to keep a few motors turning. And we import a dribble of other stuff along an unbelievably inefficient chain of middlemen, and most of it's eaten by the armies. He jerked his head toward that part of the sky which the handmade airplane had crossed. That's one reason we've got to have reunification, so we can rebuild. And the other? Woodworth asked softly. Democracy? Universal suffrage? Danielis swallowed. And so fathers and sons won't have to fight each other again? Those are better reasons, Woodworth said. Good enough for the Espers to support. But as for that machinery you want, he shook his head. No, you're wrong there. That's no way for men to live. Maybe not, Danielis said. Though my father wouldn't have been crippled by overwork if he'd had some machines to help him. Oh, I don't know. First things first. Let's get this war over with and argue later. He remembered the scout, now gone from view. Pardon me, philosopher. I've got an errand. The Esper raised his hand in token of peace. Danielis cantered off. Splashing along the roadside, he saw the man he wanted, halted by Major Jacobson. The latter, who must have sent him out, sat mounted near the infantry line.
The scout was a Klamath Indian, stocky in buckskins, a bow on his shoulder. Arrows were favored over guns by many of the men from the northern districts. Cheaper than bullets, no noise, less range, but as much firepower as a bolt-action rifle. In the bad old days, before the Pacific states had formed their union, archers along forest trails had saved many a town from conquest. They still helped keep that union loose. Captain Danielis, Jacobson hailed. You're just in time. Lieutenant Smith was about to report what his detachment found out. And the plane, said Smith imperturbably. What the pilot told us he's seen from the air gave us the guts to go there and check for ourselves. Well, nobody around. What? Fort's been evacuated. So's the settlement. Not a soul. But, Jacobson collected himself. Go on. We studied the signs as best we could. Looks like non-combatants left some time ago. By sledge and ski, I'd guess. Maybe north to some strong point. I suppose the men shifted their own stuff at the same time, gradual-like. What they couldn't carry with them at the last. Because the regiment and its support units, even field artillery, pulled out just 3-4 days ago. Grounds all tore up. They headed downslope, sort of west by northwest, far as we could tell from what we saw. Jacobson choked. Where are they bound? A flaw of wind struck Danielis in the face and ruffled the horse's manes. At his back he heard the slow plop and squish of boots, groan of wheels, chuff of motors, rattle of wood and metal, yells and whip cracks of mule skinners. But it seemed very remote. A map grew before him, blotting out the world. The Loyalist Army had had savage fighting the whole winter, from the Trinity Alps to Puget Sound, for Brodsky had managed to reach Mount Rainier, whose lord had furnished broadcasting facilities, and Rainier was too well fortified to take at once. The bossmen and the autonomous tribes rose in arms, persuaded that a usurper threatened their damned little local privileges. Their protectees fought beside them, if only because no rustic had been taught any higher loyalty than to his patron. West Canada, fearful of what Fallon might do when he got the chance, lent the rebels aid that was scarcely even clandestine. Nonetheless, the National Army was stronger, more material, better organization, above everything an ideal of the future. Sink O'Donnell had outlined a strategy. Concentrate the loyal forces at a few points, overwhelm resistance, restore order and establish bases in the region, then proceed to the next place, which worked. The government now controlled the entire coast, with naval units to keep an eye on the Canadians in Vancouver and guard the important Hawaii trade routes, the northern half of Washington almost to the Idaho line, the Columbia Valley, Central California, as far north as Redding. The remaining rebellious stations and towns were isolated from each other in mountains, forests, deserts. Bostam after Bostam fell as the Loyalists pressed on, defeating the enemy in detail, cutting him off from supplies and hope. The only real worry had been Cruikshank's Sierra Command, an army in its own right, rather than a levy of yokels and citymen, big and tough and expertly led. This expedition against Fort Nakamura was only a small part of what had looked like a difficult campaign. But now the Rolling Stones had pulled out, offered no fight whatsoever, which meant that their brother Catamounts must have also evacuated. You don't give up one anchor of a line you intend to hold. So? Down into the valleys, Danielis said, and there sounded in his ears crazily the voice of Laura as she used to sing. Down in the valley so low. Judas! The major exclaimed. Even the Indian grunted as if he had taken a belly blow. No, they couldn't. We'd have known. Hang your head over, hear the wind blow. It hooted across cold rocks. There are plenty of forest trails, Daniela said. Infantry and cavalry could use them, if they're accustomed to such country. And the cats are. Vehicles, wagons, big guns, that's slower and harder. But they only need to outflank us. Then they can get back onto 40 and 50 and cut us to pieces if we attempt pursuit. I'm afraid they've got us boxed. The eastern slope, said Jacobson helplessly. What for? Want to occupy a lot of sagebrush? No. We're trapped here till they deploy in the flatlands. Danielis closed a hand on his saddle horn so that the knuckles went bloodless. I miss my guess if this isn't Colonel Mackenzie's idea. It's his style for sure.
But then they're between us and Frisco, with damn near our whole strength in the north.
Between me and Laura, Danielis thought. He said aloud, I suggest, Major, we get a hold of the CO at once. And then we better get on the radio. From some well, he drew the power to raise his head. The wind lashed his eyes. This needn't be a disaster. It'll be easier to beat out in the open, actually, once we come to grips. Roses love sunshine, violets love dew. Angels in heaven know I love you. The rains which filled the winter of the California lowlands were about ended. Northward along a highway whose pavement clopped under hoofs, Mackenzie rode through a tremendous greenness. Eucalyptus and live oak flanking the road exploded with new leaves. Beyond them, on either side, stretched a checkerboard of fields and vineyards, intricately hued, until the distant hills on the right and the higher, nearer ones on the left made walls. The freeholder houses that had been scattered across the land a ways back were no longer to be seen. This end of the Napa Valley belonged to the Esper community at St. Helena. Clouds banked like white mountains over the western ridge. The breeze bore to Mackenzie a smell of growth and turned earth. Behind him it rumbled with men. The Rolling Stones were on the move. The regiment proper kept to the highway. 3,000 boots slamming down at once with an earthquake noise, and so did the guns and wagons. There was no immediate danger of attack, but the cavalrymen attached to the force must needs spread out. The sun flashed off their helmets and lance heads. Mackenzie's attention was directed forward. Amber walls and red tile roofs could be seen among plum trees that were a surf of pink and white blossoms. The community was big. Several thousand people. The muscles tightened in his abdomen.
Think we can trust them? He asked, not for the first time. We've only got a radio agreement to a parley.
Spire, riding beside him, nodded.
I expect they'll be honest, particularly with our boys right outside. Espers believe in nonviolence anyway.
Yeah, but if it did come to fighting... I know there aren't very many adepts so far. The order hasn't been around long enough for that. But when you get this many espers together, there's bound to be a few who've gotten somewhere with their damned psionics. I don't want my men blasted or lifted in the air and dropped or any such nasty things.
Spire threw him a sidelong glance.
Are you scared of them, Jimbo? He murmured.
Hell no.
Mackenzie wondered if he was a liar or not. But I don't like them.
They do a lot of good, among the poor especially.
Sure, sure. Though any decent boss man looks after his own protectees, and we've got things like churches and hospices as well. I don't see where just being charitable, and they can afford it with the profits they make on their holdings, I don't see where that gives any right to raise the orphans and pauper kids they take in the way they do, so as to make the poor tykes unfit for life anywhere outside.
The object of that, as you well know, is to orient them toward the so-called interior frontier, which American civilization as a whole is not much interested in. Frankly, quite apart from the remarkable powers some espers have developed, I often envy them.
You, Phil?
Mackenzie goggled at his friend. The lines drew deep in Spire's face. This winter, I've helped shoot a lot of my fellow countrymen, he said low. My mother and wife and kids are crowded with the rest of the village in the Mount Lassen fort. And when we said goodbye, we knew it was quite possibly permanent. And in the past, I've helped to shoot a lot of other men who never did me any personal harm. He sighed. I've often wondered what it's like to know peace, inside as well as outside. Mackenzie sent Laura and Tom out of his head. Of course, Spire went on. The fundamental reason